Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iris scans, facial recognition systems, digital fingerprinting. The whole new world of surveillance and tracking options now on an iPhone, maybe soon in the hands of your local police officer, already at border crossings, at some DMVs, and showing up on Facebook. Biometric tracking and surveillance are about to make a big leap forward. So is this Big Brother, Minority Report, the dystopia, or is it security? Is it inevitability? This hour on Point, liberty, security, and the big new push in biometrics. You can join the conversation. Do you know where your face is on file? Has a police officer asked you yet to stare into an eye scanner? Are we ready for this? Is this the end of anonymity? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Steven Spielberg's 2002 film Minority Report showed a world where crime could be predicted and stopped before it happened. Here, where eye scans are the norm, and where advertising is ready to recognize you. In the film, John Anderton, played by Tom Cruise, walks through a mall as a flurry of holographic ads call out to him.
A road diverges in the desert. Lexus. The road you're on, John Anderton, no is the one you're less going traveled. Kyle.
Minority Report's consumer in the mall recognized by his eyeballs. Joining me now from New York is Julia Angwin, senior technology editor at the Wall Street Journal. She wrote recently about the dozens of American police departments around the country who will soon begin using portable biometric scanners. Julia Angwin, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here. What's in the works, Julia?
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Minority Report was about retina scanning, actually, which was sort of the hot thing at that time. It turns out that iris scanning is different and is actually the thing that is becoming much more prevalent.
Retina at the back of your eye, iris right at the front of your eye, but they're both eye scans and they're both about keeping track of people.
Yeah, the difference is that iris is something you can capture with a camera. Retina scan, you have to use some infrared light. And so actually, iris scans are easier to do. You just need a camera that can take a high-resolution photo, which is why we are now seeing this device that I wrote about where it's actually just a camera attached to an iPhone that police are going to be using to take iris scans to do facial recognition, and it also captures fingerprints.
Wow. I mean, I'm reading here that U.S. forces and local forces, NATO forces in Afghanistan and Iraq have done a lot of this. I mean, a lot. Afghanistan, 1.5 million Afghans are now in databases operated there. Roughly one in every six males of fighting age. In Iraq, 2.2 million people, Iraqis, in databases. That's the equivalent of one in every four males of fighting age. Soldiers, police officers take digital eye scans, photographs of the face, fingerprints. Is that what American police will now be equipped to do with this equipment, Julia?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit different equipment than the military uses. So the U.S. military has been using these very rugged devices. They're about 3 pounds, and they're designed to withstand the heat of Iraq and Afghanistan deserts. And, you know, they are kind of gigantic.
Tough stuff.
This is tough stuff, and it's also just, frankly, too expensive for local law enforcement. Mm-hmm. So this company that we wrote about in Massachusetts has basically taken that same idea and made a lower-cost version. It's just a piece of hardware that's about 2 inches thick that attaches to the back of an iPhone, and they're selling it for $3,000 a piece, which is still a lot for local law enforcement, but within the range of possibility. But it does a lot of the same types of things. It does the iris scan, the facial recognition, and the fingerprint, which is what those devices do.
Now, it's about 1,000 of these about to go out to 40 police departments. How's it actually work? Let's say a policeman on the beat has one of these gizmos attached to his iPhone. How close does he need to be? How's it just physically work to grab the iris scans and the facial images for facial recognition?
So for iris scans, they need to be pretty close to your eye. So they would come probably between 4 and 5 inches away from your eye and take a high-resolution picture of it. And so that would most likely be done with the cooperation of the suspect. Facial recognition, they can take a picture from 5 or 6 feet away and get usually, if the lighting is good, enough of something that they could compare to their database. So that's something that you could see maybe they would do without cooperation, although all the officers we spoke to said they're only going to use this when they have probable cause and are already, you know, in the process of an arrest or a search.
Of course, we'll see how that unfolds,
right,
jurisdiction
exactly.
by jurisdiction. And then once they've got – and fingerprint, digital fingerprinting as well on the back of this gizmo, I guess?
Yeah, they'll do the fingerprint on the back, and that's sort of common. I mean, they have mobile fingerprint readers already. Although I think it's worth pointing out, since we're going to probably veer into the legal territory here, that the Supreme Court has said that fingerprinting is a kind of search. And so if you are – if a law enforcement officer walks up to you on the street and says, would you like to be fingerprinted? If you say no, then they have to have reasonable suspicion in order to force you to do fingerprinting.
What if he says, stare into this gizmo on my belt for a minute? Can I say no?
Right.
Can I just refuse to open my eyes?
Well, that's the confusing thing. So right now, it's perfectly legal just to take a picture of anybody on the street. I mean, if you walked up to me on the street and took a picture of me, I might be annoyed, but you would be within your legal rights because I'm in public. And since this is essentially just a camera, it's not really clear whether this falls under the law that governs photography or whether the law that governs something like fingerprinting, and it hasn't been tested yet in court.
And now the thing that makes all this interesting and effective is the database behind it, because and the increased power of software and computers to sort of take zillions of images of irises and eyeballs and faces and track them over time. How do police intend to use this, and how does the database help them?
So the police have said that we've talked to, and we only talked to a couple who are planning to start using these in the fall, have all said we're going to use it the way we use fingerprinting, which is when we have reasonable suspicion, because we want to be cautious. Basically, they don't want to be the test case that goes up to the Supreme Court that, you know, has to make the decision on the use of this technology. But the database is an interesting thing. So all the law enforcement agencies that are getting this device have agreed to share the data amongst themselves in a database that's managed by this private company, BI2, that makes the device.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hope of BI2 and of many of these law enforcement agents is that they'll be able to build a more robust database. A lot of these guys are local sheriffs, actually. Some of this funding is from the National Sheriffs Association. So they're local sheriffs. They don't necessarily have access to the greatest database of criminals, and they might be looking for somebody from another state, and they don't have access to that state's database. So they're hoping to build a pretty robust database of images. Right now, the database is actually just filled with images of prison inmates, because BI2's technology is already used in a bunch of prisons. One thing they do in prisons is they check people, not all, but in some, they check people in and out with their irises, because it is such a good way to identify people. And there's a weird thing where people are sometimes letting the wrong person out of jail, so they need to know who they're letting out.
But here the situation, even on the street, I guess, would be ideally, from that law enforcement perspective, if this worked, whether a person had an ID or not, whether they were honest about their identity or not, whether they were forthcoming about who they were and what the criminal record might be or not, just an image of their face or their irises, and the police would know. They could compare it to what they've got in their database and know right there. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that is the idea, that they can basically double-check your identification, or if you don't have identification, they can identify you. That's the hope, and this is something that is caused a lot of trouble for these law enforcement agents, but it's also something that you and I as citizens might not want to be identified all the time.
Well, who's going to own this database, and what's to keep it from, I don't know, a year or two or more down the road? You know, there are cameras all over the place now. What's to keep the government or even a private corporation, once my face or my eyes are in this system, from just tracking me wherever I go? You know, a computer says, well, now, you know, Tom's here, now Tom's there, now Tom's there, like 24 hours a day when I'm walking around.
Yes.
Who's to say I won't be tracked?
Right. Well, there's really no one to say that. I mean, that's where the technology is going, and the law just really hasn't caught up. I do think, as a society, we're going to have to grapple with this. You know, we are tracked every minute of our day. Our iPhones are sending home little notes to Apple all the time about where we are, and our Android phones are sending to Google. So there's just a huge amount of data about where we are, and it's getting better and better every day. And, you know, I think the only thing we can hope is that these companies and governments are are too incompetent to link all the databases together.
What's your sense of the appetite for this in law enforcement, just for starters? Is that a lot of folks putting their hands up saying, yes, we want that? Is this likely to become standard police equipment in this country soon?
Well, actually, yeah, we did find a lot of enthusiasm for it among law enforcement agents. They were concerned about the price, but they weren't concerned about any of the civil liberties issues. They were, I mean, except for the fact that they wanted to be cautious with it. But they were mostly excited about a new tool for identification.
And so 40 police departments that would have it this year, do you have a sense of when this might be absolutely standard, when it would show up frequently?
Well, you know, the companies that make the stuff for the military, some of them are also selling to local law enforcement. Their devices are more expensive. But this is a burgeoning field, particularly iris recognition. There was a really restrictive patent that prevented a lot of advances in iris recognition until 2005. So there's been an explosion in that field for the past 6 years, and there's a lot of companies out there offering technology. So I do imagine that we're going to see a lot more of this.
Facial recognition technology and more going mainstream, Julia Angwin writes. Julia with The Wall Street Journal, thank you very much for being with us, helping us get started here today. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about eye scans, facial recognition systems, and the big new push in biometric surveillance. Facebook's got it. Your local police department may have it soon. We're asking where this goes. Some fear Big Brother, Minority Report. Others say this is inevitable. Others say this is real security. Joining us now from Atlanta is Daniel Castro, a senior analyst with the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, specializes there in cybersecurity, data privacy, and information security. Daniel Castro, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having us on.
We're going to hear in just a moment from Oren Kerr, great legal scholar at George Washington University, but help us understand the extent of the application of this, first of all, and to think about the databases a little bit, Daniel. First of all, on the Facebook front, now we're reading that Facebook is also using facial recognition technology. What are they using that for?
What Facebook is doing is they're allowing users to tag photos that they upload with their friends' names. So in the past, what Facebook had is you would upload a photo and you would say this photo has these three friends in it, and you'd have to manually enter their names. What Facebook is doing with their facial recognition technology is allowing you to upload photos and then have the Facebook software automatically recognize which of your friends are in the photo and tag it for you.
So one of these kind of magical online things where I don't even start typing it in and it's already telling me what I'm going to want to write there if I want to tag it with friends' names.
Right, if you want to tag it with friends' names.
Now, how is it doing that? What is it doing technically that permits it to do that?
So it's actually a little different than what's going on in some of these larger examples of what police are doing, because you have a very small search that Facebook has to do. What it does is you upload a photo, and it can identify where in the photo are faces. So maybe there's three faces in the photo.
Mm-hmm.
And then it creates a little unique identifier for each face. It says these are the five properties that are unique about this face. These are the five properties that are unique about this face.
Are those measurements or ratios, or how's it doing? The software
is. There's a variety of different types of algorithms that can do this, and some algorithms are better than others. There's not one way of doing it. There's actually a lot of different ways of doing it.
So that part, the facial recognition, is not so different, I suppose, basically, from what's behind the police system. I mean, they're using it in a database to sort lots of many, many more faces. But even Facebook, it's some version of that facial recognition algorithms.
Yes, at some level, it's very similar. What's different about it is, and what I think confused a lot of people when they first announced this, is people thought that Facebook was searching through the billions of users that they have and identifying who's in the photo. That's not what it does. It only searches through the number of friends that you have in your social network.
But I mean, you write that users are adding tags to photos at a rate of 100 million tags per day, so it's not like a lot of this isn't going on. It's high volume.
Right. It's very popular. It's a very popular feature, the tagging. And of course, Facebook's photo recognition software is actually really useful for users. It saves them a lot of time.
But there's also a big trust issue here. I mean, you say Facebook is not doing it across billions of photos, sort of tracking you wherever you might show up. But I guess theoretically, with this technology, they could.
Well, this is a big question, and it's not just, I think, for Facebook. It's for a lot of companies. You go into stores, and they're recording you with their security cameras. If you use any online service, you're typing, and actually how you type is a biometric identifier. It's unique to you. There's lots of different types of biometric information that's out there that can be collected about you and can be used. And there's a lot of open questions about how companies should manage this data.
The databases are critical here because there's been photos and images and all kinds of info on all of us out there for a long time. It is the database that lets you scan across all that, you know, billions of bits and bytes and track somebody down. How good are those databases now, Daniel?
Well, the facial recognition technology and other kind of biometric technologies, you do have a database. You have what's called kind of the fingerprint where you have to match something about the biometric identifier to the database. And those are getting better and better over time, but they're not perfect. You have false positives, you have false negatives. And that's, you know, that's the nature of it. It gets better when you have small databases. That's why it works really well on Facebook, and it works really well when you're talking about identifying from a small population. So, for example, making sure the right prisoner leaves the prison, making sure out of 100 FBI most wanted, you can identify those people. But it's really hard if you're trying to match many to many.
Of course, and the better the algorithms get and the better the databases get, the better or scarier, depending how you look at it, the whole system gets. And putting our privacy and trust in Facebook on that front has not been exactly a winning proposition over time. Daniel Castro, please stand by there in Atlanta. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington Orrin Kerr, professor of law at George Washington University, teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, computer crime law. He's a leading scholar on the Fourth Amendment, talking about, of course, search and seizure. Orrin Kerr, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Can we just talk about the basics first of all? I don't know. I'm pulled over for speeding, and the policeman pulls out one of these new gizmos and wants to capture my face and maybe do an iris scan, put this up within a couple of inches of my eyes, have me stare into it, asks me to do that. Am I required under the law? Do I have to? Do I have to comply?
A difficult question, actually. So realistically, 99% of the time, the police are going to say, will you do this? And people will say, oh, of course, officer, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, but you know how that goes. They say, will you do it? And you feel like you have to. But
Absolutely. People feel like they have to. The courts say you don't in most circumstances. You can actually say, officer, I'd rather not do that. What makes it very tricky here is that what the Supreme Court has said is, with reasonable suspicion, the police can compel, for example, a fingerprinting, which means that if the officer commands it, says you have to do this, then you have to do it. So the way that the law works is that if it's phrased as a request, you generally have a right to say no. But if it's phrased as an order, you have to do it.
I can't say, officer, I want you to get a warrant, or maybe like a search warrant before I'll open my eyes. Do they need a warrant to force me to open my eyes?
We don't know is the short answer to that. The law distinguishes between sort of control, physical control of a person for a temporary period of time, what the law calls a Terry stop, which only requires reasonable suspicion. That's less than probable cause. But then the law says that if the government is doing more than just controlling somebody, that's going to require more, typically a warrant, a search warrant based on probable cause. And so forcing somebody to open their eyes for an iris scan, I would think would require a warrant based on probable cause. And that would be different from, for example, facial recognition technology, which is just going to be a picture, does not require the person to agree to cooperate to do anything. So in all likelihood, I would say the facial recognition technology, not very closely regulated by the Fourth Amendment, but that iris scanning, if somebody wants to say, listen, I'm not going to open my eyes or I'm going to keep my sunglasses on, so you can't do that iris scan, in all likelihood, the government would need to get a warrant in order to force the person to cooperate.
Professor Kerr, step this up then for us to a kind of constitutional high level here, thinking about the Fourth Amendment on search and seizure, and thinking about the whole sort of impulse of the U.S. Constitution. I mean, obviously written in a time when none of this was really even conceivable. And yet here we are with facial recognition and iris scans and biometrics, plus cameras all over the place now. It is not hard to imagine a kind of minority report situation where you could be more or less tracked any time you were walking around because some camera would have an eye on you and some facial recognition software could be at work. And, you know, you could hypothetically be tracked any place, any time, maybe by anybody with hacking and everything else. Do we have some kind of constitutional protection against this level of biometric surveillance, if that's what it should evolve into?
Usually the Supreme Court has responded to new technologies by effectively updating the constitutional protection to say, hey, this is the new technology we have. We need the technology. We need the Constitution to follow the new technology. So I'll give you an example. In the 1920s, the big surveillance issue was wiretapping. Mm-hmm. And initially the Supreme Court said the Fourth Amendment does not apply to wiretapping because this is sort of a new technology. By the 1960s, the U.S. Supreme Court changed course and said the Fourth Amendment does regulate technology. And that, today we have cases on email, for example. That's protected by the Fourth Amendment. And just recently, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case on GPS surveillance. GPS surveillance placed on a car. Is that regulated by the Fourth Amendment? This is a constant problem that you have in the constitutional protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, that the police are constantly coming up with new technologies to try to catch the bad guys. And the question is, how's the Constitution going to respond? So in a lot of ways, this is a work in progress. We're going to have to see how the courts respond to these problems. And then the legislatures are available as well to enact protections, privacy protections, where the courts don't.
Let me get a couple of calls right here. Nina in Boston. Nina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I think we should be all for the scanning. I think that would be a great thing, because if you didn't do anything wrong, what do you have to hide?
Okay, I totally get that point, but do you have, what about privacy, or what about, you know, do you like to sometimes walk around and be anonymous?
Not really, because I don't know, I think it would be helpful technically, because what if, you know, somebody that did something wrong is driving around speeding? That would be like a good way to catch somebody, whereas, you know, the rest of us, we didn't do anything. Go ahead, take my iris scan.
Yeah, Nina, we've got it. Let me put it to our legal scholar. What about that in sort of U.S. constitutional terms, the formulation, you know, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to hide, so bring it on. What do you say, Professor Kerr?
It's a common public reaction, not one that the Constitution really acknowledges. And I think even that reaction, the I have nothing to hide idea, I think most people kind of see there's a reason why people don't say I have nothing to hide. And by the way, here's the key to my bedroom. I have nothing to hide. By the way, here's everything I own. Here's my bank account number. Why don't you come with me? You know, people do have things to hide, even if they're not worried about the police. Keep in mind, though, that we have to worry about not only the police acting in good faith, catching bad guys, but what if the police have these powers to do things that are not legitimate law enforcement techniques? What if they're trying to just monitor people who might be, could be political enemies, could be unpopular people. We need to worry about both the good faith uses of the technology and the bad faith uses of the technology, and ideally come up with a way of getting the good while keeping out the bad.
I mean, you think of the furor over the scanning at airports recently, and clearly a lot of people who presumably have nothing to hide have been pretty up in arms about it. This is on a different scale. Jerry in Norfolk, Virginia. Jerry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. He was actually touching on what I was just going to discuss. We have a pretty openly democratic government now, but who's to say 10, 20 years from now, it's a little bit more repressive. This type of enhanced surveillance, hard for us to organize protests and, you know, organize political opposition parties. And I want the government to be fearful of its citizens, not the other way around.
Jerry, I appreciate that. Orrin Kerr, again to you. Just the freedom to protest, the freedom not to be tracked all the time. Now, we clearly have the freedom to protest, but do we have the freedom not to be tracked?
There's no general right not to be tracked, but the question is, what powers do the police have to conduct that kind of tracking? And there are really two things we need to think about. We need to think about what does the Constitution say, the Fourth Amendment, for example, prohibition against unreasonable searches and seizures. And then the other question is, what do the legislatures have to say? What does Congress have to say? What do the state legislatures have to say? They can pass laws that say, while the Constitution may allow the police to use these technologies in certain ways, we want to limit the way that the police can use these technologies. So they could, for example, limit the use of when these scans can occur. They could limit what happens to the information, what happens to the records of the iris scans or the facial recognition information. They could say the databases can't have information be disclosed from those databases. They could have protections for those databases. There's lots of things that the legislatures can do that go beyond what the Constitution does. And I think really the key question we have to keep in mind is, what are the uses of this technology that we as a society want? And what are the uses of the technology that we as a society don't want? Of course, and we need to think about ways to have the first without the second.
Of course, there's the society, and then there's individuals. Daniel Castro, personally, I don't really want to walk into a mall, Minority Report style, and have all the electronic billboards calling out to me by name and offering me this or that. I mean, what about private use of all this information that's coming into databases now? Do we need legislation or oversight of how private companies use this, the biometrics that they're also gathering in enormous volume?
Well, we certainly want transparency. I think that's the first step. We need to know who's collecting the data, where the data is being stored, and how it's being used. But I think what's really important to keep in mind here is there's so many efficient and so much efficiency and effectiveness that you get from using the technology that you don't have right now. So you might not want to walk into a mall and receive ads, but if your child is kidnapped, you want an Amber Alert that isn't just a notice to everyone, but that's actually helping you using the technology to help you find your child. And that's something that the studies have shown. What's really interesting is that the technology is improving so much that they've done tests now where you use a computer to do facial recognition, and then they have people doing facial recognition themselves. And it turns out that the computer is actually better than people at doing this.
That's totally amazing, given how good human beings are at doing this. Forgive me, Daniel, but let me get Judith in Charlottesville. She has direct experience here. Judith, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I was flying back from Australia 2 months ago, and I was coming after 15 hours flight and standing in a long line. I was in immigration and handing in my passport, and so I was just expecting it to be stamped and then carry on through. Mm-hmm. And I was suddenly told to look into the camera directly, and I was sort of a little bit shocked, looked away slightly and feeling, but I really didn't want to do this. But he said, look straight in and look directly ahead in a command. And so I did it because I thought, what am I going to miss my flight? What do I do?
Right.
And bearing in mind that I've purposely not gone on Facebook because I really do not.
Was this U.S. immigration? Judith, forgive me. Was this American U.S. immigration or Australian?
This was American immigration. I'm a resident alien. I've been here for 18 years. Yeah. And I was just coming back into the country, into America. It wasn't done the other way around. And I feel sort of violated, and I just wondered, when I say violated,
I just wonder
what rights I have to ask them at the L.A. immigration, look, excuse me, I didn't give permission, can I have my eyeballs back?
Yeah, good luck to you. Judith, I appreciate that call. Oren Kerr, we just got half a minute before the break. There's a command from the immigration officer, and now her iris scan, presumably, is in, U.S. government data banks. Did she have an option to say no to that?
She probably didn't have an option to say no to that, and the reason why is that it occurred at the border. The U.S. Supreme Court has said there are very special rules that apply at the border because of the needs to have control over who comes into the U.S., who leaves the U.S., and so as a result, I think it would be very difficult to challenge that in the immigration setting. The easier case challenge would be, what if just a person who's approached on the street and asked to submit to an iris scan, what if they said no? That's where you get the real more difficult legal issues.
Judith, I fully understand your unease right there. Oren Kerr, please stand by. Daniel Castro with the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us today, Daniel.
Thanks.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about eye scans, facial recognition systems, and the big new push in biometric surveillance. It's not new, but it is growing. Facebook's got it. Your local police department may have it soon. We're asking where this all goes. Minority Report, a little bit more from that movie. You may have seen it years ago now. Tom Cruise, character John Anderton, trying to flee authorities, trying to avoid detection by ubiquitous eye scanners. His character, John Anderton, undergoes a black market surgery where he has his eyeballs replaced. Next thing you know, he's walking around. A holographic store clerk greets him, John Anderton, as someone else as he enters a store.
Hello, Mr. Yakamoto. Welcome back to the Gap. How those assorted tank tops work out for you?
Mr. Yakamoto.
Mr. Yakamoto. You've got Mr. Yakamoto's eyeballs. You are Mr. Yakamoto in that dystopian version. But it's very real. At the D9 technology conference in May, Google's executive chairman, Eric Schmidt, told a journalist, Walter Mossberg, here that his company, Google, had built a facial recognition system but had not deployed it, had kept it from the public.
We built that technology and we withheld it. As far as I know, it's the only technology that Google built, and after looking at it, we decided to stop.
Why?
Because of the issues that I was describing, the fact that people could use this stuff in a very, very bad way as well as a very good way.
It's our subject today, facial recognition, biometric surveillance, and tracking. Orrin Kerr, professor of law at George Washington University, has been with us. And joining us right now from New York, Douglas Rushkoff, media theorist, author, documentary filmmaker. His latest book is Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for Digital Age, now out in paperback. Douglas Rushkoff, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, good to be with you.
We know this isn't new technology. We know there are databases full of all kinds of images. But when you read about these little handheld gizmos being deployed to police departments now, of Facebook using this for photo recognition and tagging, I mean, suddenly I think the public is beginning to key in here to what's going on. Are you comfortable with this as a media theorist? Do we just have to roll over and accept this as the way things are going?
Well, I think we may have to accept that this is the way things are going, but then the solution, I'd argue, is not to roll over, but to become intelligent about it. In other words, to understand what's happening. You know, I find it, you know, it's quaint when a woman, you know, the woman from Australia said, look, I have not gone on Facebook, you know, because she doesn't want to be part of that. Well, it's like, honey, you're already on Facebook.
What do you mean? If she hasn't gone on...
Whether you have an account or not, your pictures are there because you went to a wedding and someone mm-hmm. else took your picture and labeled who you are, and then Facebook can use its algorithm to find every other picture of you at every bar mitzvah and tea party you've been to. So, you know, we're all in there. It's not even a matter so much anymore of us making a conscious decision. Although even our conscious decisions, I feel like people don't understand that every email they write, every SMS message, every phone call they make on a cell phone, this is all digital material, and it's all in one way or another recorded as if it were etched onto the walls of the Parthenon.
So when police start saying, hey buddy, look into this camera for a second and do it now, or photographing lots of people in facial recognition systems, where are you with that? Like, oh, who cares? There's already so much biometric information out there. This is just one little facet of a great big, you know, thing that's already underway. As citizens,
I'm not who cares. Mm-hmm. I'm delighted that it's at least becoming as visible as it needs to for people to understand that this is the world that they're living in. You know, that we're going to have to either effectively legislate our privacy or learn to fight back, you know, in whatever ways we can, you know, which is kind of tricky in itself. You know, the fear in Minority Report is not that you walk into a Gap store and the store knows who you are. The real fear that Philip K. Dick was talking about mm-hmm. was, what about when these databases are used predictively? You know, that's the real holy grail now, is for these big data sets, as they're called, for them to be able to mine them to figure out who's going to do something next mm-hmm. that we need to preempt. Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets that where it gets a little bizarre, is their ability to model, you know, to model our behavior, compare it against others, and then treat us differently based on what they suppose we will do.
And this isn't just crystal ball gazing. This kind of predictive algorithms are used all over the place with stock markets and everywhere else already. Look at A, B, and C, D, E, F, G patterns, and pretty soon you can imagine what H might be.
Right, and it's a new way. I mean, yeah, in the stock market, it would be a new way of leading trades before people can do them. But what it does is it creates really an alternative technological universe that's preempting and taking advantage of our decisions before we make them, if it's even able to accurately predict us in every single case, which of course it isn't.
Orrin Kerr, there's a kind of technological determinism that you could hear in this music that, look, the technology changes, and so this is just how, one way or another, society is going to change along with it. But what about Americans? I mean, Douglas calls Judith quaint in her perspective, but what about Americans who feel, look, there are certain guarantees of privacy and individual liberty with which this is not consistent, and we don't want to go down this road. Is there some shield in the Constitution for Americans from the enormous power and weight of this technological, you know, drift, or do you just have to roll over?
You don't have to roll over. There are several possible shields in the Constitution. And then, of course, there's Congress and state legislatures can regulate this sort of technology. One case to watch, I think, is this case that the Supreme Court agreed to hear just a month or two ago. In the coming year, the Supreme Court will decide whether and how the Fourth Amendment regulates government use of a GPS device installed on a person's car to watch them as they drive around and to know their location over a long period of time. That case, I think, will give us some idea as to how the Supreme Court might approach cases involving iris scans or facial recognition technology, and more broadly, how the Supreme Court is thinking about the intersection of changing technology and constitutional protection.
Douglas Rushkoff, we've all been following this phone hacking and police corruption story in the U.K. in recent days. And one of the things that went on there was police were telling reporters who worked for Rupert Murdoch, they were pinging, I guess, cell phones to tell those reporters where within a block or two individual British citizens were at any given moment. Now, and that's crude, compared to if you've got facial recognition and you can track them with cameras all around the streets. Cell phone pinging is relatively crude compared to that. Orrin Kerr says we could look to Congress or the Constitution to protect us on this front. Do you find that quaint as well, Douglas?
Well, I'm reminded, you know, Thomas Edison. What did he say? Abuse of power isn't limited to bad guys in other nations. But so, I mean, I'm comforted by the fact that in the case in the UK right now, at least, you know, these guys are being caught and people are up in arms. But I feel like these. Well, I know that these techniques are much more widely practiced than we might like to believe. I know people that work in SMS, cell phone messaging centers, and they see what's going. They see what's going by. They find out whose cell phone is a celebrity's, and they want to know what, you know, Lindsay Lohan or Tom Cruise are texting.
Wow.
You know, it's not. It's very hard to create technologies that are genuinely safe in this regard. And what happens is young people who are raised in this particular kind of media space, like the younger caller before, say, well, look, I've got nothing to hide. I mean, they almost see it as, why should my behavior be dictated by shame? I'm not ashamed of anything I do, even if it is slightly illegal. I'm not ashamed of it. You know, so I could smoke pot, or I can be gay, or I can do anything that might be restricted in a certain place.
So bring it on.
And bring it on. I mean, what they don't realize is they don't understand things like selective enforcement, and that you don't really want to be doing things that are illegal and be on the record doing it.
Or wait till you're on the wrong side of popular public opinion at some moment, or a government perspective, and you want to protest.
Exactly.
Let me go to Chesapeake, Virginia, and David. David's calling in. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
You know, I don't really, in my opinion, I don't think that this is about the U.S. Constitution and people's rights. I think what it boils down to is law enforcement and our, you know, at the local level and state and at our federal level, as you know, as well as the government, looking at a more accurate and cost-effective way to obtain, you know, data on a person, such as, you know, criminal, you know, people that are criminals, or, you know, in the cases of espionage. I mean, our court system, both at the federal and local levels, are, you know, losing a lot of cases based on just identity. And then you have a lot of criminals that are sitting on, you know, death row or in jails now that, you know, may or may not have committed, you know, certain crimes, and they come to find out later, you know, years later that they didn't. And DNA is so hard to obtain and costly to process that by using the retina scan and along with a facial, you know, program, it gives you the most accurate and cost-effective way to identify a person, you know, that you have, you know, suspicions about. And you know, and that, I think that's what's, you know, the real topic here. And once you, you know, understand why, you know, or how this information is being used, it kind of sets the stage of where it's going. And,
David, let us pick it up right there. Our time grows short, but, I mean, you're quite right. It will be. It has been already used that way. I'm looking at a news story from February of this year saying that a judge ruled for the first time that biometric facial recognition could be submitted as evidence, first time such evidence had been used in a criminal trial. Douglas Rushkoff, how about it? Accuracy and cost effectiveness in identifying citizens or non-citizens in this country, for that matter. How about those as drivers of this?
Oh, well,
good trade-off?
Having ways to be authenticated based on your personhood, I mean, to me is actually is comforting in an era of identity theft and with as many difficulties as we have proving who we are. I mean, I don't really mind the Homeland Security having my retina scan so I can get through immigration. I mean, that's, you know, that's the nature of the beast. What I'm more concerned about is, you know, is Facebook having it? Is Google having it? Is and people who can then build an app on top of Facebook having it and using it for things that I'm not aware of and things that I wouldn't want them to do.
But what about if Homeland Security has it, and that lines up with what David's saying, and they can have good control at the border? All right. But if they've got it, then presumably the FBI's got it, and let's say it's facial recognition technology, and pretty soon, you know, wherever you walk around in New York, wherever you go past a government camera, they, in a supercomputer age, they know, oh, there's Douglas Rushkoff right now. Is that okay with you?
It's going to require vigilance. It's not whether it's okay or not with me. It's the fact that it's happening and going to continue happening. You know, and if they're not doing it, someone else will be doing it. You know, it's on a certain level, technology marches on. These abilities come to us, and what we owe ourselves that is the kind of vigilance that goes along with learning how these technologies work and being involved, actually participating in the regulations and in the ways that they're deployed.
It feels to me like it could overwhelm individual vigilance. But let's see, James, Los Angeles, California, calling in. Hi, James. Thanks. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Listen, I've noticed is that read an article is that the entire Los Angeles Police Department now is every one of their Chevy Impalas or new patrol cars are going to have. They're going to have these roving ALPR cameras on there. And it's not going to be that hard for those cameras who scan 200 cars to change to biometric information. I mean, everyone says we need a new law. We have a law. The right of the persons to be secure in their houses on their persons shall not be infringed. Well, I don't know about you, but that's the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution.
James, and when you say ALPR, is that a camera that's what's high?
Yeah, it's a ALPR. Different companies make it, automated license plate recognition.
Oh, I see. But just sort of aim it a little higher, get all the faces as you drive by.
Yeah,
let us pick that up right there. I apologize, but our time is short, but I really appreciate the thought, James. Oren Kerr, what about it? There was an uproar over, you know, Google doing its street-level photographing of so many things because people, among other things, show up in those photos. What about policemen and other security agencies just sort of scooping up gazillions of faces all the time and instantly, you know, knowing where you are if they want to know where you are? Fourth Amendment, is it okay?
Under the Fourth Amendment doesn't regulate what happens in public. That's really the difficulty, or at least surveillance in public. So the Fourth Amendment regulates private spaces, homes, insides of cars, insides, letters, packages, and the like. But it doesn't regulate what is exposed to the public. And so the difficulty is, of course, our faces are exposed to the public. So if the police are monitoring public spaces and looking at essentially taking photographs and using facial recognition technology. At least under current law, the Fourth Amendment would not regulate that. Again, I want to point again to this GPS case the Supreme Court is going to hear. One of the interesting things about GPS surveillance is that is out in public. So it may be that the Supreme Court changes the approach that it has had to the Fourth Amendment in the past and starts having the Fourth Amendment regulate some sort of public surveillance. If so, it may be that that provides a basis for regulating the facial recognition technology as well.
Douglas Rushkoff, I won't ask you for a legal opinion, but surely, I mean, beyond, you know, the framers surely imagined a margin at least of anonymity, even in public, that this technology could make quite impossible ultimately. What do we do with that? Can we still sort of be the kind of independent people we imagined ourselves or our ideals told us we had the right to be in this country in this technology era, Douglas?
Well, we might have to redefine what we thought of as private, you know, and that's going to, I think, increasingly shrink. You know, when I talk to the most optimistic techno-enthusiast young people today, they imagine a future where the internet is sort of the test run for a world in which everybody knows everybody else's thoughts. You know, they really believe, many young people, that we are moving into a much more collective and shared form of consciousness for which all of these privacy concerns are kind of the practice and getting us comfortable with the fact that we're going to know what everyone else is thinking anyway, almost in an extreme version of what a small town used to be. You know, and if they're right, then this is all stuff that we're going to have to get used to and get used to working with, that we're going to have to develop not just new laws but almost new manners, so that we can willfully provide one another with the privacy we need to experience individuality.
Quite incredible.
Go into the woods, away from the cameras.
Yeah, wow. New day, new way. Call me old school on this one, but it is absolutely fascinating. Douglas Rushkoff, author of Program or Be Programmed, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Oren Kerr, professor of law, George Washington University, it's always great to have you here. Thanks so much for being there.
Thanks as well.
Listeners, a lot to chew on right there. I'm old school. I'm old school on that one. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.